Welcome to the Lighter Side of the Dark Side. It's your weekly freak show here on Renegade Radio and all podcast catchers and YouTube. And as always, I am Dark Mark, the Goth Comedian, and this is my co-host, everybody's favorite horror writer, Nicole Six.
Hello.
A horror writer. Okay. Yeah, you got to say writer in there too.
No, she has written horror novellas, and we will send you some if you'd like.
Oh, great. Because you just can't say, this is my sidekick, the whore. You know?
No, she's not a whore. She's a horror writer.
That's what I'm saying, man. And you're like a whore.
Already.
Dreams you're like a horror comedian. What's that?
I was saying that dreams do come true. Yeah. I was a 11-year-old boy in Westminster, Colorado, and my mother had Los Cochinos on vinyl, and we used to listen to it all the time and laugh. And now I'm talking to one of my comedy heroes, not only my comedy hero, the reason that I'm Buddhist today, and we'll get into all that. Tommy Chong needs no introduction, but from Cheech and Chong, from That 70s Show, from Half-Baked, from being in jail, from being back with Cheech and Chong, the man's done it all.
Being on the dark side to being on the right side, yeah.
Now he's on the dark side. How are you, Tommy?
I'm fine. I'm really well. Thank you.
You are a hero of mine. I can't tell you enough how grateful I am that you're coming on the show. And I've got a lot of questions for you.
Okay, let's get to it before you get me going on something where I'm at that age where I'm hard to shut up.
Well, I'm at that age too, so I'm going to let Nicole ask the first question.
Okay.
I was going to ask, what is the most positive benefit CBD has had in your life?
CBD? Well, it helped me recover from my cancer operations. You know, I had prostate cancer and rectal cancer at the same time. Yeah. Well, actually, I got the rectal cancer from doing a biopsy for the prostate cancer, which was stupid because it was obvious I had it. So there was no need for a biopsy other than to do a medical procedure, which everybody gets paid for. And that ended up giving me a rectal cancer. And I got operated on. I didn't go the marijuana route like a lot of people wanted me to go. What I did, I went to the best doctor, surgeon you could find in that field. But I used CBD to heal.
And
that's when it really came into being. Because after the operation, I was on the opioids, you know, the Oxycontin, or, you know, I never could figure out how to say Oxycontin. You know, the people got codeine or oxycodone or cotton or something. But anyway, it's a powerful, it's like being on heroin, apparently. And I'd never done heroin, so I was kind of like really looking forward to at least trying it. I've always wanted to try heroin, and so I did. And I see the danger. Because you feel so good, you don't even know that you've done drugs.
Oh, man.
And so, you know, you just think, well, with me, I had to hit a button because I was hooked up, automatic. And I'd hit that button. I wore that button out. But the minute I got out of the hospital, I went on CBD injection. And that took away any desire for opioids, totally.
That's great. And,
yeah. So that's my story on, why I love CBD so much. What CBD does, it calms the mind.
Yeah.
THC can excite the mind, also calm it, but the CBD for sure calms everything. And when you're calm, your body reacts, you know, not in an emergency way. Like when you get any kind of hurt, see, your body has to protect itself. And so if there's a bruise or something, it'll send blood to that area.
Right.
And that's called inflammation. And so CBD, when it calms everything, it calms the urge to send all that inflammation to that area. And that to me, now that's me, that's my layman.
You're hardly a layman when it comes to this, Tommy. Come on.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying? I'm not a medical guy. I never,
right.
In fact, I never finished high school. You know, I'm one of those self-taught kind of guys.
But marijuana gave you a career and saved your life.
For sure. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And even before that, it saved my life with cigarettes, because I was a smoker right up till I was 21. You know, from 14 to 21, I was not a heavy smoker, but I enjoyed cigarettes. And then I stopped enjoying them. And then I finally decided to kick the habit. And that's how I did it with pot. Every time I felt like a cigarette, I'd light a joint. And you know, and to this day, I still can't smoke a whole joint.
Wow.
I'll take a couple of tokes and I'll put it out. Yeah.
You're just talking a lot of myths here, Tommy.
Yeah. No, it's true. No, I will light it up 2 seconds later. You know what I'm saying?
I was going to say, I'm a social smoker. I can't finish a whole joint either. I like to be in a circle and just pass it around.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's too much.
Yeah.
It's just too much. When you've had enough, that's enough. It's like whiskey or something, you know, a little shot glass. That's all you need is that little shot, you know. But alcoholics, they take it to the, you know, where they get glug the whole bottle. And I found that with pot too, because I start making homemade bongs, you know, like this one here out of kombucha bottles. This one here.
Awesome.
Oh yeah.
See, and I got a great Travis, a glass blower from Boulder, Colorado. He made the top for me. This is my new line. So I'm going to be, but you know, smoking a bong takes energy. You know,
yeah, you're gonna get the finger and the whole thing.
Yeah. And you gotta breathe. You gotta do that inhale, and then when you inhale, there's like a joint. You can take a puff. You can't puff on a bong.
Right. No, a big hit right away.
Yeah, you gotta draw on that bong. You know, yep. And for heavy smokers, it's really good. You know, tobacco smokers, if you're smoking, you know, out of like a Chinese water pipe,
right?
That, you know, you can get the coal hot enough so you can just take a little puff. But to get it going, it takes a lot of lung power and energy, and that's a lot of THC being put in your system.
Right.
Too much.
On a bong before, taking too big of a rip, like it really, I can feel it burn my lungs.
Oh man, I was on the Snoop Dogg Up in Smoke tour.
Yeah.
You know, I showed up and he got me on stage smoking out of a 6 foot bong, you know.
Oh my goodness.
I was gonna ask you what the biggest bong you ever smoked out of was.
Yeah, that was it. That was it. And I, because I was in front of a crowd, I had to show up, do my thing. And almost killed me, man. Oh man.
Yeah,
everybody thought I was cool. Yeah, they thought I was acting the fool, you know. You know, being a comedian. Oh, look at Sean Wither writhing around on the stage like he's dying. Oh, that's a good act, man. That was for real, dude.
Well, I see all the guitars behind you, and yeah. I didn't want to get into this because I was telling my father about this and he had no idea. I don't know if Nicole or some of the fans know you. In the movies, you play like a horrible guitar player, but you are really a very talented musician, good guitar player, and wrote a top 20 song for Motown Records.
I did. And
you
started
out as a musician, and you became very successful.
Yes, I did. Yeah. Well, it's successful enough to know that that's not where I wanted to go. You know what I mean? It was always a dream of mine to do the Chitlin' Circuit, you know, because I was in a rhythm and blues band, you know, practically all my life. You know, I started, you know, real early at 15, something like that, 15, 16. And then I got, you know, we put a R&B band together And then, you know, of course, I got turned on to all the R&B stars, you know, and I met, in fact, we started our R&B club in Vancouver by hiring Ike and Tina Turner, the Ike and Tina Turner Review. And we had them for one night, a Tuesday night, for $700.
That's wow. How much
the whole review cost, $700, because it was a Tuesday night.
In 1960,
it had to be 62 or 3, around there. Yeah, 63, probably around 62, 63. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't seeing Tina Turner live in 1963. And Ike Turner's no slouch himself.
Oh, she was such a fox. Oh, so hot. And all they had the whole review. The review, you know, the Tina and the Ikeettes and Ike himself and the band, $700. That was killer. And then we played, our band played, because that was the whole point. You get a name to open the room, and then we took over. But we were so popular that the city closed us down.
Oh my goodness.
What do you mean?
Well, we found this, what used to be a movie theater, and they turned it into a ballroom, the owner of the building, because, you know, the movie industry moved downtown. And so this was in the suburbs. And so it was, we called it the Blues Palace. And it was a pretty size, it had a balcony, you know, it was a big, big theater. And they leveled the floor on the main floor, you know, and we had a beautiful, beautiful stage. It was incredible. But we got so popular that we drew all the hardcore teenagers back in the day and right. The hardcore thugs, you know, for want of a better word, you know, all the badasses that hang around. They don't go in the dance. They just hang outside and cause trouble and drink. And it was like a focal point for all the people. And back then it was all alcohol. There was no weed. I got turned on to weed real early, but I wasn't sharing it with anybody. You know, that was my own private stash, you know. So everybody was into alcohol, and the next morning, that nice, quiet suburban neighborhood was littered with beer bottles. Now, had I been in the club business, I would have taken advantage of it. I would have collected the beer bottles, made money doing that, and then I would have made sure that every time, you know, we had a dance, that we'd have a crew come and clean that night, right. You know. But I never had those smarts.
Is it true that Diana Ross got you signed to Motown Records?
Yes, she did. See, we had another club in Canada. Oh, by the way, that was the Blues Palace was the first and only club where we actually came up with the first and, you know, the deposit, the rent, and the first one, the only one. No, I take that back. We had another club in Chinatown, which we did. But after that, I failed at two clubs. And so we just went on the road and started playing music. And we got better and better. And so this one guy he bought a building, and it had a steakhouse in the basement, empty. And so he asked me, hey, do you want to put a club in there? And I said, yeah. And so he let me in there for 6 months rent free, and that's where Diana Ross saw us, because we had it was an after hours club. Okay. and they played they did the Forum, or you know, some huge arena or something, and then she came after. That's where all the black people would come to our club, because we had the best R&B band, you know, on the West Coast actually, and that's
with
where
half white, half Chinese guitar player.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they had no idea what I was, you know. but they didn't
I've
care,
seen
you know.
I it's puzzling to me too.
I really inspired the. I inspired a lot of people, you know, especially the Chinese community. You know, they love and the Japanese and the Philippines. You know, oh,
Yeah, we just lost your visuals there, Tommy.
I got it. Potential scam was the thing. But and so we had an after hours club and everybody hung out there. You know, it wasn't just Diana Ross. We had all the great blues giants. Red Fox was a steady customer of ours. That's everybody. Great. Because at the end of the day, you know, you perform your show, you know, and in Vancouver, like you perform your show to a very nice, white, polite, white crowd. And then you come down to our after hours club and it was all mostly mixed, you know, black mix, everything. And
real fun.
It was happening. It was happening. You could dance. And we had, you know, I was such an accidental club owner. See, this is why I know the power of prayer really works, because I had no clue what I was doing, you know, but we somehow, you just played by ear, you know,
right.
And there was an empty banquet room beside our club that wasn't being used. And our club was tiny compared to most, you know, it was a small after hours club. It had a dance floor. But the overflow would go into the dining room, into the spare room that we had, which turned into a quiet room. It was genius because people, you know, wanted to hit on girls, talk business, whatever. You had a room where you go there, no loud noise, no waitress bugging you, nothing. And so it was an incredible club. It ran for about, I was saying 5 to 7 years.
That's great.
And we did good. And then the guy sold the building. And because he gave us the club, we had to leave. You know, there was no way of saying, you know, that we got grandfathered in. It wasn't we got grandfathered out.
But the other thing I hear, and we're getting to Cheech and Chong in a second, but I heard that Michael Jackson and Jackson 5 got signed because of you.
Yeah, we discovered them. What happened when after we did Does Your Mama Know About Me and the hit record, we toured around the Chitlin' Circuit and we played the Fox Theater in Detroit and Uptown Theater in Philly and all over the place. And we played the Regal Theater in Chicago. And that's where the Jackson 5 had won a contest. And the winner of the contest where they got to open for headliners at the Regal Theater. And the headliners was Jerry Butler and Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers, and we were the first to really hear Michael and the boys, and they did a cover of My Girl, and they did a better version than the Temptations, if you can believe that.
Really?
It was so well, Michael. That voice, and he was a tiny little guy.
He's 10 years old.
Yeah, he had to turn the little Coke carton over just so he could see the mirror in order to comb his hair. He was short for his age, you know. He grew later, but, you know, in the beginning, he was a tiny little guy, which made him so cute. And so we saw them, and Bobby Taylor was the one that invited Joe and the gang. It was only the boys and Joe to come and live with him in Detroit until Motown signed him. And so Joe and the boys, they all came to Detroit, and they had to wait a month before Berry Gordy got around to auditioning him. And of course, as soon as the audition happened, oh my God, Motown. And that's what broke up the Vancouvers, by the way.
Right.
Because Bobby went with the Jackson 5, produced their first album.
Oh, okay.
That was his reward. And then Bobby ended up becoming, you know, Bobby Taylor with Melinda. You know, he had
it's so weird how the universe works. It's like,
yeah.
Michael Jackson was supposed to go one way and Tommy Chong was supposed to go another way.
That's exactly it. Exactly it.
You might not realize at the time.
I had a job at Motown, you know, playing backup band for Berry Gordy. Really liked me. We had a nice relationship, and because I wasn't, you know, I was more or less straight shooter. You know, you know, there was no games or nothing. I wasn't trying to be anything. I was just right. who I was. And so I got fired from Motown because I had to get a green card. I had to get my
from Canada
work permit. Yeah. Yeah. And no one knew what it was. And so when I missed a gig to get, you know, to do you get interrogated, you know, the meeting.
Right.
When I came back to the gig, they had fired me. and that was another plus. And Barry Gordy phoned up a couple of days later and said, "No, you're not fired." And I said, "Yeah, I think I will. I'm going to stay fired because I want to become a Barry Gordy. I don't want to work for one." And that's when I really became Tommy Chong, you know.
Right.
Up until then, I was just a guitar player of the Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers. You know?
Right. Now, I have to ask because I've heard a few different versions of this, but when did you meet Cheech?
Cheech was up in Canada. In fact, he became a Canadian. He became a landed immigrant in Canada during the Vietnam War. Although he wasn't up there dodging the draft, he was up there as part of a secret army that was going to defend America if the Vietnamese attacked from Alaska. You know, so it was a secret army. Not very few people know about that. But in the meantime, he was scuffing around. You know, he tried to ski. That was the year before I met him, and he broke his leg that badly. And he was healing, and he was a writer for Poppin', a hippie magazine. And he was delivering carpets too for money to live with, to right. eat on. And I changed topless. Oh, we got another nightclub given to us.
We were so successful. You just can't stop going to nightclubs.
We were so successful with the After Hours, the Elegant Parlor, that another friend of mine had a nightclub, and his dad was trying to get into show business. Chinese guy, he owned these buildings, and he had a supper club in Chinatown called the Shanghai Junk. And he gave it to me. And I turned it into a strip club. And then I went on the road with Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers.
Right.
And then coming back, when I was on the road with the Vancouvers, I discovered we're in San Francisco, and I discovered improvisational acting, the right. committee in Second City. I discovered in Chicago was Second City, and in San Francisco was the committee. Right. And so I
that got was like Fred Willard and those guys, or
Fred Willard, and all the great guys, Howard Hessman.
From WKRP,
Howard Hessman. By the way, Howard. Long story short, I changed the strip club into a improvisational strip club. The girls would still get naked once in a while, but it would be in the form of a skit, you know. And then at the end of the show, they would dance. They'd all dance, you know, exotic dances. But it wasn't a strip club anymore. It was an improvisational comedy theater.
It was more of a burlesque thing.
We were doing jokes out of Playboy magazine.
Right.
We would take Playboy, you know, the improv club would, every improv theater, they would do a show, then they'd have a request from the audience, and then they would have an intermission, and then they would come back and do the requests that the people requested. And so I had the same format at my club. It was called the City Works, by the way.
Right.
But the only trouble is our club, we never officially changed anything. We just went from a strip club to doing burlesque comedy.
Here's the thing, though. The thing about Cheech and Chong that separates you guys, to me, from, say, you know, Smothers Brothers, Abbott and Costello, Lauren Hardy, even modern teams like Tim and Eric and, you know, people like that, is that to me, it's always been more of a sketch. It's like a two-man Saturday Night Live, like a two-man sketch, rather than like, okay, here's just a straight man, here's the funny man.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, we did that because we could, you see. And eventually, we inspired, you know, we definitely inspired Saturday Night Live, you know, because Belushi was a huge fan. And he was already in Second City. And then Second City tried to copy us. Everybody, the committee, everybody had to try to put out records like we did, you know.
Right.
Because but we were sort of a hybrid. I was a musician.
National Lampoon Lemmings is definitely.
Yeah. They tried. They all tried. And that's where Howard Hessman really, he hated Cheech and Chong, but I think he liked me personally, even though, you know, Hessman and those guys, they all had an attitude because they were actors, you know, and they weren't performers. They weren't comedians. They were actors. And they were doing, because a lot of the committee stuff, and that was acting exercises, right. You know, that you did in acting class. Well, Cheech and Chong, I mean, I was just trying to entertain money, you know, keep people in a strip club spending money.
Want an acting exercise. They needed, it has to be immediate.
Yeah. They needed the funny. They need it right away, you know, and we eventually, you know, we became pretty good actors because just from doing it, you know, just doing it all the time.
That's great.
But Hessman, I was after WKRP, all those guys, by the way, Chico and the Man, remember that sitcom?
Yeah, that was a total ripoff for you guys.
Well, the guy, Jimmy Comax, that wrote it, We got offered everything at NBC. Brandon Tartikoff literally said, whatever you want, we want you guys on TV. And so Jimmy Comax followed us around for 3 months and watching every show that we did for 3 months. And then at the end of the, when he had it together to do a show, I nixed it. I said, no, I don't want to, you know, you lose, once you become a sitcom artist, you lose control.
Right.
You know, now the writers take over and the producers take over, you know, and the actors, they're the last guys they worry about, you know.
Right.
just say your line, shut up, say your lines, you know, that kind of attitude. Well, with me, I wanted to be a movie star. I didn't want to become a, you know, has been television, you know, comedian. And so we turned it down. And so then Comax called old man, one of our bits, the old man in the park, Chico and the Man. And he actually apologized to me for doing it. And he said, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, it's a total ripoff, but that's the way it is.
No.
Okay, another question.
When that goes on the air and there's a big hit, what do you think?
Oh, congratulations. But I didn't want to be any part of that world, man. I didn't want to be told where to go, where to eat, you know, when to get up, you know, when to rehearse, when to do all that shit. I you know, Cheech and I, we rehearsed one time. We had one rehearsal, and that produced our first bit, Dave's Not Here. And then after we did, it was a rehearsal. And the way it worked was that Cheech went outside of the studio, and it was hot. It was a little Charlie Chaplin movie studio. And there's a little enclave there that was in the sun, and it was hot as hell. It was hotter than, you know, it was probably around 100 degrees. Mm-hmm. And he's out there knocking on the door. Well, he went out there, you know, and he'd knock on the door, and I was supposed to open the door and let him in. But the door locked from inside. So he's out there, he knocks on the door, and I was trying to record it. So I said, who is it? And then he was kind of shocked him because I was supposed to just open the door. And then it was a nice pause. And he goes, it's me, man. Come on, open up. And so then I saw the beginning of a bit. So then I waited and he knocked again. Before that, I didn't know if I recorded it or not, because after he talked, when he talked, I looked up at the door. And when I looked back at the recorder, nothing was happening. And so I'm staring at the recorder and he knocks again. And this time I saw the needle jump. So I said, oh, it's recording.
Yeah.
So I said, well, we'll start the bit again. So I said, who is it? You know, more to piss him off than anything else. and then he said, then he got a little mad. It's me, man. Come on, open up. You know, I think the cop. But he never broke character. Never broke character.
That's great.
And we did that. We did that whole bit. And finally, when I let him in, he was mad, throwing stuff around. I thought he was going to hit me. And then I said, listen. So we played it back. And we must have laughed for a good hour. We played it over and over again. And every time we played it, it got funnier and funnier. And then we recorded it that night. And then that was our first recording. So we had Lou Adler, we had everybody, engineers, everybody there. But the bit only took like a couple of minutes. And then everybody's there. So what else you got? You know, because usually it takes half a night to warm up before you get into recording.
Right.
And we already recorded the bit. And so then we came up with Blind Melon Chitlin. And then I realized, and I took Lou aside and I said, we just need a little situation like we had, you know, little mixed down room and one engineer. And then we did all the recordings with just
right.
the three of us. Yeah.
Now let me ask you a question for about a couple other things you turned down.
Sure.
I heard that Harold Ramis wrote Stripes for Cheech and Chong.
I believe it. Yeah.
It was, yeah. They said it was Cheech and Chong joined the army.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what they did, they had it cast before they approached us, you know, and we are already knee deep in our next movie, Cheech and Chong's next movie. And the reason we call it next movie is because we couldn't use Up in Smoke because we had split with Lou Adler by then. And so we were right in the middle of next movie and they come up with the offer. Well, you know, we're doing a movie already. And besides, you know, again, working like Ramis and those guys, it'd be like working for a Petartikov, you know, being told what to do, where to go, how to look, you know, what to say, all that shit, you know. And so we turned that. We turned that one down. We turned down. I just found out that we turned down a Ron Howard movie too.
Really?
Yeah. What's Howard's partner, Brian Glazer?
Right.
Yeah, I met Brian in Aspen a few weeks ago. And we had never talked before, and him and Cheech were good friends, but I'd never met him because I never hung in that crowd. And right. He told me that, yeah, him and Ron came and pitched a movie to our producer, I guess it was. But we turned down a lot of things.
I heard that there was also supposed to be a Friday the 13th meets Cheech and Chong.
I never heard about that one. But yeah. I don't doubt it.
Apparently, somebody pitched that like Cheech and Chong meet Jason, that you guys were gonna be camp counselors.
Oh yeah, I did hear about that. Yeah, you're right. You're right. But you know, again, you know, we turned down a lot of stuff. But I told Cheech just recently, you know, the only thing we never did was a horror movie. But you know, I lost control of Cheech. See, all the movies I had total control, but then he didn't like that, you know, because in the records it was equal, you know.
Right.
But in the movies you had to have a guy in control, and that was me.
Right.
And that's why we did next movie. You know, all those movies were.
I gotta say that. And I've just watched them all in preparation for this, but Up in Smoke, Next Movie, Nice Dreams, Things Are Tough All Over, four of the funniest movies I've ever seen in my life. I can watch them over and over and over again. None of them have a plot.
Yeah. They are hilarious.
Yeah.
Well, is that intentional that they don't have a plot?
Well, if you look at it, because it was the ongoing life of Cheech and Chong. They're doing that now with the streaming, with the things now. You know, you think it's over? No, they got more to go. No. You know, it's never over. And then they just stop. And that's basically what Cheech and Chong. See, Up in Smoke, Lou Adler was the director, and the reason we broke up was because Lou Adler, he got the best of him, because I really directed that whole movie Up in Smoke, except for the cop bits, you know, which Lou Lombardo, Robert Altman crew.
And by the way, if people don't know, Lou Adler, great music producer, produced Carole King and Beach Boys and just about everybody, and produced your records.
Yeah.
How did he end up as a movie director?
Because we tried to, when I started writing a movie with another guy long before we did Up in Smoke. And because I knew we were going to go into the movie area. And then because Lou wanted us to keep making records and keep touring. And then it got to the point where it would have been our third or fourth trip to Australia. And I didn't want to do that anymore. It was too hard work. You had to write a new show. You miss summer, you miss summer in LA. You're working, you know, and there was no break. And so I wanted to do a movie. And so I worked with Joel Asker, and we wrote a movie which we never shot. It was Jack and the Weedstock. But I never had a chance to pitch it. So when Lou heard that we were going to do a movie, then he arranged the financing. See, he got in with the financing. And so he financed the movie. And then we're trying to get directors and Rob Reiner. We asked Rob Reiner, but Rob Reiner was too connected with the committee. He was too much friends with the committee. So he turned us down. And then we ended up getting Floyd Mutrix, who had done American Graffiti, I think it was, some hot rod show, but he didn't work out. And so then Lou said, well, Paramount would be comfortable if he directed it, you know, if he was like the director of name, you know, officially, calling, making sure that it gets shot, you know. I got snowed all the way, by the way.
but you really directed Up in Smoke, not Lou Adler.
Yeah, I always believed. Lou would tell me stuff, and I just believe every word he said. You know, I'm a Canadian. You know, I'm one of those guys. You know? And you know, when people tell me things, I don't doubt them. You know, I believe them, and I believe that. You know, but it was true because Cheech and I were, you know, Up in Smoke wouldn't have been as good as it was if it wasn't for Lou, because what Lou did, he brought the whole attitude of using names and using real good people. That was his genius, always, you know, always at the top level. You know, it's like getting a shopper and they know what shops to go to, you know, as opposed to going to the easiest one, you know, Kmart or something. You know, you get guys that they seek out these things, and that's the way Lou Adler is.
You guys inducted him into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, so I guess there's no hard feelings.
We got what? Oh, we inducted him, Lou. Oh no, there was never hard feelings. Okay. No, even after we broke up, there was hard feelings because what happened, Up in Smoke became a big hit, and we got screwed financially, you know. I mean, I don't give a shit about any kind of, credit, who did what. I never did, you know. Right. And that's, but I had to take over the directing because you have to be in charge of that shit, you know. If you don't, then someone else, you leave it that laying around, someone else will grab it like they did.
Right.
You know, but Lou, no, we're good friends. Yeah, we're, you know, I mean, that, episode. What I always look at the positive thing, because if it wasn't for that happening, we wouldn't have done next movie. We wouldn't have done, all those things are tough all over all those movies.
And by the way, this is just my opinion, but I think Cheech and Chong should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
You have more hit records than a lot of people that are in there.
Yeah, it takes money. That's all it takes. Yeah, you know, but that's
inspired so many rock bands.
Yeah,
and you can even say that "Earache My Eye" was the first punk record ever.
Yeah, you can for sure, because we were inspired by
the before the Sex Pistols, before the Ramones, and it was a top 10 hit.
Yeah, yeah, I mean for sure, but you know, I mean, it's all about money, and by the way, they honor you in lieu of money. You know, you don't get paid anything for being the guy. Yeah, oh, by the way, they do that with comedians too. Like they wanted to honor me at Skirball. They're going to honor me, but they wanted me to do, you know, a half hour at least. You know,
right?
No money. You get a plaque. Yeah, you know, and then they have a bunch of other comedians on before you. And then you come on and you're basically headlining, you know.
For free.
But what I did, because I'm not really a comedian, you know. I learned how to do comedy, but that's really not who I am.
You're a funny guy.
Well, who I am is more spiritual, and whenever I get a chance, like if I'm on cameos or anytime or doing interviews, I will jump into the spiritual rap right away. And so when I was at Skirball, you know, they had all these comedians and they're doing their shtick, you know, doing their funny stuff. I got up and I started doing my spiritual rap. And my wife was there, Shelby, you know, she was my comedy partner for so many years.
Right.
Before Cheech. Right. She stood up, gave me the cut. That's enough of that. She gave me the, it looked like part of the act, you know.
That's hilarious.
Well, when she did that, then I sort of steered it into, you know, so I had some punchlines where people could laugh, you know, and I did that. But yeah. No, I'm not really anything, but I can do a lot of things.
Right. Now, and also Lou Adler owns the Roxy.
He owns the Roxy, yeah.
So every time I drive by the Roxy, I think of Up in Smoke.
Yeah.
And I do have a question for you about Up in Smoke. What? Two questions. Why did Cheech play guitar and not you? And why were your drumsticks so big? They're like baseball bats.
I know. Isn't that something? There's a most of rule. You know, you've heard the Wolf of Wall Street, you know, that guy. I was in prison with him, and I was writing my memoirs, and so he started writing his book, and he wrote a few pages, and he you know, he's younger than me, and he looked up to me, so he handed me what he wrote. He said, "What do you think?" And I read it, and the guy's got a photographic memory, so he can copy anybody, you know, and he copied Tom Wolfe, and so I said, to be honest, you haven't written anything, you know. He just copied Tom Wolfe. And then he got a little defensive, and he says, so what should I do? And then I told him the most of rule. And he said, what's that? I says, it's a movie. People are going to see a movie. They want to see the biggest and the best. You know, that's why you get the prettiest girls. You get the handsomest guys. You know, it's got to be the most of. It's got to be the most wildest car chase and the wildest everything. And so with Up in Smoke, if I'm going to be a drummer, I got to have the biggest drumsticks that there were on the market. And the reason Cheech played guitar, because he's singing lead in the thing. Right. I was never a good lead singer. I'm still not. I can sing, but I'm not a lead singer. And it looked better on screen because I would never put my guitar playing on anybody, because I still to this day, I don't consider myself a guitar player. I know I can play guitar, and I've been playing since I was 8-9 years old. I used to be a second guitar or a backup guitar for a fiddle player when I was young. And he taught me what I know in show business today, you know, which is stamina. You got to have stamina. You got to be able to, you know, find out what you want. And if you don't get it right away, then keep doing it till you get what you want, you know.
Right.
And there's certain rules, you know, because a lot of people acting, a lot of in all walks of life, they just don't try hard enough. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when you're playing for a dance, you can't just say, okay, I'm tired now, I'm gonna stop. You gotta go to the end of the night until everybody's left and gone home and you play the midnight waltz, you know, the last waltz. Then you can relax and go home. And the rule was is that keep it simple and give the people what they want. That was the two rules that I followed all my life. And look where I am.
You're in a room full of guitars.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, is it true? Is it? No, go ahead, Nicole.
I was just going to say, I realized we didn't announce any of our sponsors.
Right. Raise Energy Drinks, the sponsor. Audible.
No, what's the drink? What's the drink?
The energy drink's really good.
What is the drink again? Let me see.
Oh, this is Raised Energy Drink.
Energy drink. Okay. Yes. And what?
Zero calories, zero carbs, zero crash.
Is it carbonated?
A little, very faintly. It's not a lot of carbonation.
But it's refreshing.
Yes, this is better than the stuff you'll get at the stores. You can order a case on our thing.
Well, tell them because I gave them such a big shout out that they got to send me some, okay?
I was going to say, we would just send you some. Don't worry.
Well, we got stuff to send you. Don't worry about it.
Okay, what's the next one?
Some Renegade CBD and Kush. We got some stuff. We got some of that to send you.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Before the show, I had the sugar-free gummies, and they're really good. They have a lot of new sugar-free snacks now. That's what Charlie's been working.
Oh, I'm going to try that. I'm going to try that. What else is in my goodie bag?
You're going to get some Raise Energy Drinks. You're going to get some CBD. And you're also going to get Nicole's books.
Oh, I don't know about that. I have copies. I just don't want to force anyone to read it. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to read it, that's cool. But there's no pressure.
What is the book? It's called
Some Fucked Up Shit. It's a collection of horror stories.
Oh, I love it. I love it. My daughter makes horror movies.
Well, that's amazing.
Yeah, she does. Precious. And so, I like the horror stuff.
Okay, well, then I'll send you a signed book. It doesn't mean signed by you, but I hope you appreciate it.
It means a lot, believe
me. For all the laughs you've given us, that's the least we could do.
Yeah. I love it.
Is it true that Dan Aykroyd directed some of next movie?
A very tiny little bit. Aykroyd and Belushi were doing the Blues Brothers at the same time we were shooting next movie, and so they were with John Landis, you know, this kind of nutty, crazy guy, and so Aykroyd and Belushi decided to come and visit Cheech and Chong on the set, and we're right in the middle of doing a scene, and I'm we never had time. We're too busy shooting, and I'm doing a scene where I'm peeing in on the neighbor's flowers, and they used a hose, and so I looked at the because I was using video assist, one of the first to use it, and so we were watching the playback. And you could see the hand and the hose, you know, briefly. And so I was should I reshoot that or what? And Aykroyd stepped in. He says, use it. That's perfect. That works. That works really great. And I saw it again. I said, he's right. So yeah, he did. He did direct that part.
Okay. I got to tell you, I've gotten some questions from some other fans. They all asked me to ask you about the woman that played Donna, Evelyn Guerrero.
La Donna. Ooh, La Donna.
I don't know if you're looking at your wife or what, but Donna was in your movies and everybody loves her.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to know the story of La Donna?
I so want to know the story.
Ew. Yeah.
Okay. when Cheech and I first came to LA, which had to be the 1970, I believe, we ended up here. The only place that we could work, do an open mic night right away, was Red Fox's comedy club he had on La Cienega. And I knew Red from my after hours club. So right. I called down there. Norma Miller, she answered. Red was out of town, but Norma said, she talked to Red, and Red said, of course, you know, anytime, he's welcome. You guys just come on down. And so they did a spot for us. I think it was a Monday night. And so Cheech was, by the way, he was a big bear. He was having a vacation, and I had here we are trying to make it, and stars, and Cheech is on vacation already. And so I had a call, or Cheech called me, and I told him we got a gig. And so he came back from Big Bear, and we performed at Red Fox's club. Well, in there was a, remember Lenny Bruce, the great?
Yeah, of course.
Lenny Bruce had died a year or so earlier, but he still had his entourage coming around. They had no leader, no one. So they were going to comedy clubs, and Sally Marr, who was Lenny's mother, also right. managed quite a few comedians, you know. Mm-hmm. And so she was there, and Tony Viscara, Sally's actually husband, but she was years older than Tony. Well, Tony's sister was Evelyn Guerrero's mother. And so I met Evelyn when she was she was barely out of a teen. She was still, wasn't even 20, I don't think. She was still a teenager. And she was, she's an artist. She had a job coloring stuff. She was, what do you call it? Coloring gels in animation studios. And that was one of her jobs. Anyway, she was incredibly beautiful and so funny and so hip, but beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we, and then Tony became Cheech and Chong's manager, because when we performed that night, Tony came up to me and he gave me one of the nicest compliments ever. He said, you know, he'd been seeing comedians ever since Lenny died, and I was the only one that came close to Lenny, the way Lenny thought, you know, his mindset. And that was what a compliment. Well, I found out later that Tony also had a drug problem, and he also was the one that supplied Lenny Bruce with the drugs, and that was one of the reasons that was Tony's job. Even though he would sometimes work the door when Lenny performed in clubs and that, but he was Lenny's guy, and so Tony and I became friends, and then I hired him. First of all, he was our manager, but we had to support him, you know.
I know a few managers like that.
Yeah, we had to kind of support him. And but he was with us all through our freebie area. You know, we'd perform here and there, and, you know, and we got, and he'd help us with the show. You know, he'd give us a little bit. Nothing, actually, he was really good because he knew how to do it with Lenny, you know. Just let us work it out for ourselves. And actually, it was my wife, Shelby. She was my girlfriend at the time, and I just split up with my wife, and we were living together. And she would come to the Cheech and Chong shows, and she would give us the best notes of them all, you know.
That's great.
And then she ended up in the show herself because she's got that whatever it is. But Evelyn. And then Evelyn, when we started doing the movies, anytime we needed a girl, we'd go to Evelyn. You know, we needed LaDonna. Because that was the other thing, too. I didn't want to use a name actress. I wanted to use, you know what I learned shooting movies, and that if you give people the first shot, they will give you 130% of what they can do. And so next movie, I gave the cameraman. He was King Bagot. He was just a cameraman, and he wanted to become a DP. And so he became a DP on my next movie. And
Pee Wee Herman and Elvira and Sandra
Bernhard. Everybody. Oh, yeah. Tom Hanks is like, Rita Hanks was one of the Help Me Wamba girls. Yeah. Right. Oh, tons of people. You know, the Ajax lady. We meet, you know, and I love that because, like you said about the punk scene, you know, that was new. And so we introduced that on screen. And that now it's legendary, you know. These guys are forever.
Reaction from the punks? Did they like it? Did they not?
Well, you know how punks are. You know, they don't like themselves.
Well, I heard that the Germs actually did a film something for Up and Spoken. They were cut out.
Oh yeah, the Germs. There was quite a few that did it. Yeah, we could only go with a few, but yeah, we. Like anything, you know, you got respect for what you are and what you do, not how you think, you know.
Now, I've got just a couple more questions to ask if you can hang on. I really appreciate you. I mean, I could talk to you all day. I mean, this has gone by so fast. You were not, you guys did an album. I mean, you did all the movies. You did the Corsican Brothers. You did Yellowbeard. Apparently had your European period. And then you did the album Get Out of My Room, which had the big hit Born in East LA, but you weren't on it.
Yeah. That kind of broke Cheech and Chong up, you know.
Because why didn't you do a voice on it?
Because up until then, you know, I had always, when I wrote anything I wrote, Cheech was always a star, you know. And in lieu of me writing it, you know. I would, you know, that's just the way I roll, you see. Well, when Cheech wanted to do his own bit, you know, he came up with this idea. And so I was all for it, you know. Okay, what's my part? Well, I never had a part.
Oh, no. Know?
No, I was, as Chong, I never had a part.
Well, he said he wanted you to play the cop.
Yeah, he wanted me to be the cop. But I'm Chong, you know.
Right. By that time, Sergeant Stadenko, though, on other records.
Yeah, but that's a record. Yeah, I could be that cop.
I'm talking about the song. You weren't on the song.
No, I know. Because of that. Because, see, Stadenko, I wrote that. You know, I wrote, Stadenko was Vancouver. I picked it out. I wrote the whole thing. You know, I wrote everything. Sister Mary Elephant, Cheech wrote that. You know, right. That was his thing. I came up with the concept of something for the kids, and Cheech came up with that, and then I did the other one. But for the again, you know, it's just like Tartikoff. You know, he wanted me to be a TV star. You know, but right. unless I am who I am, you know, unless you put some of me in there, you know, you can hire anybody, and that's what I told Cheech. I said that part can be played by anybody. You know, you did not write a Tommy Chong bit in there, right. You know, and that's why, you know, it was disrespectful, you know, it was very disrespectful. And that really led to us breaking up because then he got the movie. See, we attack anything. We attacked it with humor, you see, you know. And so when he did Born in East L.A., it was a story about a 15-year-old kid that mistakenly got deported. Okay. Well, if I were to write the movie, I would have Cheech and Chong go rescue the kid, you know, and we'd rescue him with humor. You know, it would be a funny situation all the way. Pretend he's our kid or whatever, you know, there's a million ways you could do it, you know. But Cheech had a whole different thing in his head. And Cheech also, to this day, he still has the character he played in Up in Smoke, you know, that made him famous. He doesn't do that character. You know, he won't look like that guy. He won't wear the mustache.
You know, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, unless it's glued on, it's just he treats it like a part. Louis, do you know who Louis Valdez is?
No.
Louis Valdez. He's the director that I think he directed La Bamba, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, he directed, he's a Latino, Chicano.
Right.
And he took Chicha aside right in the middle of our career and really gave Chicha a bad time about being the step and fetch it of Chicanos, you know.
Oh, man.
Come on.
Yeah, I'm serious. I'm serious.
That's awful.
These are jealous contemporaries, you know.
Yeah, they were
very,
sure.
Very jealous. And so they really talked Cheech out of doing that Pedro character, you know, which Cheech created. You know,
right.
It wasn't that I created and say, hey, Cheech, you got to do that.
In we fact, live in L.A. You go down the street and find 10 Cheeches.
That's what I'm saying. So Pedro's. And the way we discovered that, Cheech don't even want to admit the way we discovered it. Because the way we discovered it, when I was up in Canada, Cheech was Richard Marin. He wasn't Cheech. His name was Richard Marin.
Right.
And then we put a band together. And then when we got to the gig, it was a battle of the bands. And we were going to do a little comedy and then we're going to bring the band in. Well, he never got around to playing because the comedy was so strong.
Right.
And the band, they're a good friend of mine. Powder Blues was the name of the band okay. that they were from. And they said, "When's the next gig, boss?" I said, "No, it's just Richard and I."
Right.
You know, now Richard Marin and Tommy Chong. And so coming home that night, we were looking for a name. And then I finally said, "Cheech, don't you have a nickname?" And he said, "Yeah, Cheech." And Cheech and Chong, I mean, it just flows off the tongue.
Right.
Yeah, so easy, really Cheech and Chong. And so that was it.
You never considered Chong and Cheech?
But Cheech never, no. Cheech never really wanted to be Pedro, ever.
Right.
To him, you know, he was educated. And so when it came down to working in the Valley, and we weren't going over. We had to do two gigs in the Valley at the Irma Cafe, it was called. And they, the first show did not go over well because there were dancers. They wanted to dance. They didn't want to watch comedy. And so I said to Cheech, I said, there must be a character we can do that will get these people. And Cheech said, yes. And now he denies it. That denies it, but I was there. I know exactly what happened. He said, "Yeah, there's a character, but I don't want to do him." I said, "Why not?" He says, "It's kind of detrimental to the Chicano community, you know, Latino community." And I said, "Cheech, we're comedians. That's our job. This is what we do, you know." So he said, "Well, okay." I said, "So what?" I said, "Just tell me what's the character?" He says, "Well, he's." You know, there's a guy, we're standing outside the club and this Chicano pulled up in a lowrider, you know, he goes, "Hey man, can you tell me where Encina, Rosita Boulevard or something?" And she says, "You're on it." And he goes, oh, thanks man. And he drove off. Well, she says, that character.
Right.
So then we put a bit together, this old, like a lot of our comedy was old, memories of me working black clubs right. And remembering bits that black guys did. There's one bit where this black guy went on a date and he drove a car, but you never saw the car, it was just a chair. But he would make the car appear with pantomime, you know, maybe right. Polish it and do all that stuff and get in, got gear shifts, all that. And so I showed Cheech a little bit about that. And Cheech right away, he understood, you know. And so that's where the lowrider character came in. And so then I wanted to play the opposite of his lowrider. And so I became the red freak, you know, the guy that was so stoned he couldn't talk, you know. and I was the opposite. Cheech was really quick and fast. "Hey, what's up, baby?" And I was, "Hey, man." I was the slow guy. And that magically became the formula that really made us who we are today, you know.
Right. Yeah, huge partnership.
And so when we got very successful, then Cheech had a meeting with Luis Valdez, and they decided that Cheech would not be doing that character anymore. I mean, Cheech denies it, you know, but I know that's what happened because I was there, you know. And we turned down, when we broke up, there was a lot of movies that wanted to be made, like just talking about Stripes. Well, you know, like the Corsican Brothers was another one that where right. Cheech says he didn't want to do any more stoner movies, you know. So
right.
The Corsican Brothers was, there was no dope in it. Much to the dismay and the chagrin of the movie, the guys that bought the movie, because they only bought Corsican Brothers because we were going to do a doper version of that. But right. I you know, I said, you know, we're talented enough. We don't need to have anything to lean on. And we did a nice job with the Corsican Brothers. And a lot of people, to them, it's their the only movie they relate to, you know.
I know a few people that they don't like your other movies. They like that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they don't understand the doper humor. Yeah. It was the taste. So we had a whole career ahead of us. You know, but even in the Corsican Brothers, that's when we broke up. That's when, because Cheech was getting a divorce from his wife, Ricky, who I insisted putting in the movie, because I wanted my wife in the movie. So what I did, I put his wife in first. His wife was in Nice Dreams. Was it Nice Dreams?
No, Things Are Tough All Over.
Things Are Tough All Over. That's right. Ricky was the first. And then my wife, Shelby, was in Nice Dreams, just in the weightlifting scene
right.
for a second. And then they were both in Things Are Tough All Over. And then they were both in, they were becoming like a female comedy crew. And they were both in the Corsican Brothers. But
right.
But Cheech and Ricky broke up. And that's when Cheech and I broke up. Because he really... he was done, I guess, with right. the Pedro character. He was totally done with that. And you know, I still love my stoner character.
Right. Now, how'd you guys end up in Martin Scorsese's After Hours?
Again, you know, the word went out. We were hot. We were very hot. You know, I had Katzenberg fly all the way to Vancouver Island to get me to be in. It came from Hollywood. He flew up there with he flew up there on a prop plane and all that. He loved it. He showed up and calling him, knocking on my motel door. I was at my mother's funeral, and Katzenberg couldn't get a hold of me, so he flew up. Yeah. You got to be in our movie. I was okay. Yeah. So that's how we were with Scorsese too, you know. Scorsese had a lot of respect for us, but the whole movie industry
right.
had nothing but respect for Cheech and Chong because of our box office ability, you know, and right. And that's why we were in After Hours box right. office. Yeah.
And then you did Far Out, Man, which I think as with Born in East LA, the movie, it's good, but if the two of you were both in, and Cheech is in it.
Cheech yeah, in for a second. Man, I almost got on my knees to beg him to, you know, to be in it. And he said, no, he wouldn't do it. He would not do that character. He would not be that character anymore. He was done with it. And he was totally done. And that was basically the swan song for Cheech and Chong, you know.
Right. How did you
get
him to be in Far Out, Man? Like, you just finally
I never had any grudge against Cheech at all, you know. Never. You know, I always loved him like a brother. And it was heartbreaking when we broke up, you know.
Right.
And then I hadn't seen him for so long, you know, and then when we see him, because for a while there, you know, we were so close that we knew what we were thinking, each other's were thinking, right. even when we weren't together, that's how close we were, you know? And it wasn't until I went to Europe, you know, I lived in Europe. And that was when, and Cheech was by himself, and Cheech felt the same thing. He once flew to just spend time with me, you know, in France. In fact, the coast of France, we're at Arcachon, and Cheech already flew up there, you know, just so we could spend some time together. You know, we were that tight, but we grew apart. And then after we did Still Smoking, that was supposed to be a concert movie.
Right.
And again, I told everybody, I don't do concert movies, you know, and I just do, and I said, give me the money, I'll give you a real movie. And it made more money than I think all the concert movies. I think maybe Eddie Raw did
right.
as good as ours, but ours made a shitload of money. Because I know
you think you could,
we got checks.
Did you think you could be as big a star on your own?
No.
You never did?
No, I never did. No. You need that thing. No, a bigger star, but not in comedy. You know,
right.
not like comedy. No, I'll be a bigger star probably with my spiritual.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm bigger than ever. Like my CBDs and stuff like that. You know, right. Because figure out you got not only an icon with a comedy team, but now I'm talking about stuff that really affects people's lives.
Right.
You know, not just make them laugh, it affects their lives, and you know, it gives them a path, it gives them purpose. I do more cameos than you can imagine.
Just because
you know, sitting at home and doing cameos, I've made more money this year than I've made in eons, a lot of years.
That's great. Now, I gotta tell you, the scene in Far Out Man where Ronaldo Ray snorts the fake cocaine, one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Yes, isn't that great?
Yeah.
And then and the way we brought it back to life with a short in the guitar.
If you haven't seen Nicole, you gotta see it. But
you know, that was Sugar Ray Leonard's favorite movie.
That's awesome.
The boxer. Yeah, he would sit alone because it never got the hype. It never got the hype, you know, all the Cheech and Chong movies got. In fact, it probably got the opposite hype, you know. Cheech is it in it, so don't bother. But I had so much fun. And it's kind of special, the movie, because it was the only recording of Bobby Taylor. And Bobby Taylor died a few years ago. And that really is the only, I think, maybe some TV works that Bobby did, you know, singing. But as an actor, that was the only thing of Bobby. And also Floyd Sneed, he was the drummer of the Three Dog Night. Yeah, he's in it too. Yeah, he's in that movie too. Okay, that was
your entire family in it.
Oh, of course. Everybody was in it. Yeah.
Well, I have to touch on this, and I know it's probably a sore spot, but
no,
when I got this book, I thought it was going to be like a Cheech and Chong autobiography, and what it was a document of your jail time when you were put in jail for having somebody else ship bongs under your name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy. Can you imagine that? Well, you know, I pissed off Ashcroft. He was attorney general. I pissed him off. He lived in St. Louis, and he was a big right-wing radio guy. Well, over the years, I became the darling of right-wing media, because I would piss everybody off. As soon as I was gone, the phones would light up. Everybody would be pissed off. Well, I pissed Ashcroft off because I would out be the right wing guy says, pot's bad for you, you know, all the stuff. And I'd say, oh man, a lot of famous people smoke pot, you know, that you don't know. And I would just name up people left and right, you know. No proof or anything. Like I had a friend, Danny Sullivan, the race car driver. And so I said, oh, Danny Sullivan, he smokes pot. I've smoked
Arnold
pot.
Arnold Schwarzenegger?
that is, well, Arnold, he does, but Danny Sullivan never did, you know, right. or not in public, you know. And so it would piss off the right wing guys really bad. And I think I got to Ashcroft and I think I got to the Bushes too, because apparently the Bush girls were heavy potheads, you know, and they liked the Tommy Chong bongs, you know, the Chong bongs. And so,
I mean, George W. Bush was a coke addict.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, they all done pot, you know, whether they do it or not. Yeah. They all, yeah. Especially Obama, you know, he knew Cheech and Chong. Yeah, he knew Cheech and Chong before anybody. But anyway, the Iraqi war was such a disaster.
Yeah.
The weapons of mass destruction. They're looking for something to take away the news cycle, you know. And so Tommy Chong going to jail for bombs, they figured it's a typical George Bush move. You know,
but you didn't make a crack about weapons of mass destruction, and
I said the only weapons of mass destruction they found were my bombs. And next thing you know, the judge is going 9 months in jail. You're going.
I was wondering. I knew you didn't get that long. I was wondering how much you got. I've been in jail for 6 months. I was in a fight once. It's not my proudest moment. I won the fight, but I went to jail for 6 months. So.
Yeah,
but while I was in there, I was super focused on what I wanted to do with myself. I helped better myself. I got into programs to enrich my life and give me like a future when I got out. Like I took it very seriously. Like I didn't want to be that person, you know?
You need to read this because...
Well, the whole point when I was in there, my brother-in-law sent me the I Ching. And I threw the I Ching immediately. And the I Ching says, you're in jail for a reason.
Exactly.
And it says jails are where you go to corrective institutions, or you go there to correct your behavior.
Yes.
And I read that. And then I also realized that jail is the only hospital for poor people, homes, schools. School is the only place you're going to get schooling.
Yeah,
you're going to get and be protected from obvious violence. You know, for the most part, if you keep your nose clean, I've known many people who would commit crimes just to go back to jail because it was the only home.
Right.
It's the only home they know. You know. And so when they got these programs, you know, get these people out of jail, you know, the ones that never been there, they don't realize what they're saying, you know, because it's not that, you know, they're not that anxious to leave, you know, it's not like they got a life outside,
right?
You know, especially if they've been there long enough, their only life they know is inside.
Yeah, you know? Like there are many people that are homeless during the winter months that commit crimes in order, like small things like theft or something, just so they can be in jail and have hot meals.
And big things like, what do you call it? Those chases, you know, those car chases. You know, that's what it is. In fact, in prison, they call it something like going on vacation.
That's what it is.
Yeah, when you get out of jail, you go on vacation. Because now... you got license to rob, steal, whatever you want to do, because you're going to get caught and you're going to go back.
Yeah,
and so they do all that, you know, and that's why they drive the crazy the way they do, you know. But there's a lot of
resources in there too, though, to help you get straight. Like, I wasn't really a violent person. I had a fight with a person. It's like my only crime in the 35 years I've been alive. But I also had a temper, and there was a lot of stuff that helped me get calm and centered. I really appreciated that.
Yes, it's a timeout. It's
you both got put on timeout. But the one thing is that if they were trying to crack down on the drug trade, it backfired, because I have a theory. I think that the outrage over your sentence, and you were the only one sentenced out of all the people that were charged, the outrage over your sentence has led to where we are now, where you can get marijuana delivered to your house.
Yes.
But legally now.
Hey, they closed down bars. they closed down concerts. They closed down sporting events. What's open? Marijuana clubs.
Where you buy your pot. Dispensaries are always open.
Where you buy your pot. Like you said, you get it delivered. I used to joke about it. They said about legalization in New York. I said, well, right now, you can get pot faster than you can get pizza delivered to your house. Because I've ordered both, and usually the pizza comes first, you know. No, I mean, the pot comes first, which, thank God, then you can eat anything.
And you're hungry for the pizza.
Yeah, that's right. Pizza.
But, I mean, can you imagine, I mean, from the time you were put in jail to now, it's, you know, which has been, what, 12 years or so? It's
03. I was in there 03, 03.
Oh, well, you know, longer than in the 17 years since. But even just the last 10 years, it's across the country, with very few exceptions. Yeah. People are like, we want to make it legal. Let's make it legal.
Yeah. And the ones that don't, they're ostracized now. Like, oh, what, are you crazy? You know, you don't want that good pot money. And you know what really bugged me is when they, first of all, we got it legal medically. Now there are places that they want to eliminate the medical and just call it recreation. And now that's a little bit going the wrong direction there, folks.
I agree.
Because it is a medicine. It will always be a medicine. And if you use it recreationally, you're using it as a medicine.
Right.
You know, there's no recreation involved anywhere near pot. You know, if anything, it'll make you sharper and think, you know, a lot of people, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar would do a couple of tokes, you know, before he'd play basketball. I'm quite sure 99% of the players in the NBA do that, you know, calms their nerves, you know. That girl that got
Simone Biles, she could have used it.
She should be using it. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a medicine. It's a medicine. And I have to tell, you know, I tell a lot of people, you know, be careful with it, you know, do the rat test, you know. People say, what's a rat test? Well, when rats find something they're not sure of, they just take a tiny little bit. And then they crawl away, and they crawl away, and they see what happens to them. And if it's okay, then they eat a little more. And if it's not okay, then they'll leave it. They're okay, I'm not going near that, you know. And rats are the closest to humans of all the animals, you know. That's why they use rats and experiment for medical purposes. So you do that with pot, you know. If you're afraid of it, do a tiny little bit, tiny little bit.
Right.
Because that'll get you off.
Tommy Chong, he's been medicated for 50 years plus. He knows. Make sure you're doing the right dosage.
Right.
Yeah. And if you're one of those guys that can, you know, puff down a gram, like I was with weightlifters, bodybuilders.
Right.
You know, and with Arnold and that. And they would go over to Zabel's house, his other bodybuilder, and they had a big ass bong, and they would put an eighth in the bowl and fire it up with a torch. And the whole trick was to suck it in so that the coals would go into the water and explode.
Right.
and that would
hurt me.
You know, all the Dave Drapers of the world, you know, they got the big lung capacity, you know.
They can
the bench press 500 pounds, you know.
That would hurt me so bad.
And then they would, then it was my turn, and I took my little chicken shit toke. And
there you go. But do what makes you feel
lightweight.
Yeah. I don't mind being a lightweight. And I tell them all the time too, man. You know, when I was a kid, we never knew when we were going to get our next bit of pot.
Yeah.
And so you just, you know, I nursed a joint one time for a month. I take a toke, put it out. Take a toke, put it out. That's 2 days there. See, just take a toke. And that's how I got into comedy. I listened to Lenny Bruce. One little toke, just a little toke, and then put it out. Yeah.
But when you're around like Kevin Smith or Snoop Dogg or Mike Tyson, they all want to just like outdo you and see how much weed you can smoke. And that's, I mean, what do you say? Like, hey, I'm just having a little bit.
No. I can fake it like a dog, man. I'm an actor, man. I can puff, and not inhale anything. Just puff. I can burn all their weed to shit if without even taking a toke, you know.
Oh, wow.
Or like when I was on the Trailer Park Boys,
right?
And they had a contest, and I kept taking the bong, and I kept giving it to the other guys, and they wouldn't resist it, you know. I got them all so fucked up. They didn't know where they were.
We finally found the secret.
And then I said, "You won. You guys are the best. Yeah, you helped smoke Tommy Chong."
But by the way, your cameo as Alfred the Butler in Jane and Silent Bob Reboot is the funniest thing in the movie. It's hilarious.
It's a funny movie. I love it.
Yeah, we had fun. See, Kevin, he's the director, and he knew exactly how to direct me. Beautiful. Yeah.
He's stoned.
Well, there was no script. It was a conversation.
Right.
And then he knew how to do it. He knew how to work with people. See, it's a new world now. You know, that's why.
By the way, were you in this? I don't. The way it was shot, you were not in the same shot as Val Kilmer and the girl who played Supergirl. They did all the three shots separately, right?
Yeah.
I know it.
Yeah, because I saw Val in the makeup room. That was sad because he can't talk. He's got no voice.
Uh-huh. Right.
And he writes on a pad. Yeah. Oh, my God. I had a cousin that was, they called deaf and dumb back in the day.
Right.
When I was a kid, he was both. And he would go through changes, and he couldn't talk, and he'd do with his hands. And,
right.
Well, it was pretty sad. And Bell's at that stage now.
Yeah, I saw the documentary. It's sad. But he seems to be dealing with it pretty decent, pretty good. So,
he's Val Kilmer. He's Val Kilmer. It's another character.
Right.
Val Kilmer played some of my favorite roles. Like, he's just amazing. Like, I'll always remember The Saint as being like this really great film I watched growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh no, he's
and of course, you know, Jim Morrison. Like, no one else could have done that but him, I think.
No, he's a legend. He's a legend.
Maybe and Tommy he always Tom, will but, be. I got two more questions, and you've been so generous with your time. I really appreciate it. The first question. There's got to be a whole generation of people that don't even know you from Cheech & Chong, that know you from Half Baked or That 70s Show, or just, you know, just hanging out with the, you know, Snoop Dogg and things like that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Do people recognize you on the street? They're like, oh, That 70s Show.
It varies. It varies. And I'm very happy, you know, when I meet them. Like, I was in Tofino up in Canada, and it's the furthest west that you can go and the most wild. And I got recognized like crazy up there. And you know who recognized me? They were Serbians from Serbia that had married Croatian women. And if you did that there in their country, you could get killed because they were like mortal enemies.
Right,
and
right.
So they would get their wives and come to Canada. And they're the happiest people in the world. Oh, man, I love my fans. I really do. I think I got the best fans of anybody.
I grew up around a whole generation of people who love Half Baked. Like, it was the thing. I was like, Half Baked.
Which leads me to my last question. What is it about Cheech & Chong in particular that transcends generations, transcends race? Everybody likes you guys. Black people, white people,
you know, we took a page out of Charlie Chaplin. You know, when before Charlie became the Tramp, he was a very renowned sort of music hall musician. He's a composer, very elegant, very highbrow guy. But he couldn't make a penny doing that. And so the minute he discovered the tramp, it was a character that he discovered. Then he realized one thing. Everybody looks down on the tramp. And that was the Cheech and Chong formula. Everybody had a Cheech or Chong in their family somewhere. You know, everybody. Not just, you know, stoners or, you know, everybody, rich, poor, whatever color there is. There's the two fuck ups. And that really was our success story. I realized that, you know, and when we did Up in Smoke, I realized two things. I realized that the characters would be eternal. That's why you can never kill them off, or you can never change them. You know, that's what I'm talking about. When Cheech did Born in East LA, he changed it. And when he did that, he just cut himself off. You know, had he stayed the low rider to this day, because there's old low riders with the mustache.
Yeah,
hey, what's happening? What's happening, man? Hey, and I was gonna. In fact, when I was working alone, I had a whole bunch of those guys come up one time. I worked in Brea, California, and they didn't approach me, but they stood off to the side. And they said, "Hey, man, what's with?" No Cheech. Hey, what's with no Cheech? Where's Cheech? And they weren't saying where's Cheech as far as Cheech himself, but as far as my mindset, you know, the way I delivered, you know, the way I would talk, because I got kind of bitter, you know, and I would do not very nice jokes about Cheech, but you know, and him and Don Johnson, you know, I'd brag on that a little bit, you know. But I realized that who we were means so much to these guys.
Yeah.
That you don't want to mess with that. You don't want to mess with that. And so I learned right after that incident, you know, just like on the road now with Trump, just before the pandemic.
Right.
We started getting these heavy Trumpies, and they were they actually started heckling. You know, when I did Does Your Mama Know About Me? Cheech and I sang it. And then I heard this Trumpy yell real loud, "Boring." And I stopped and I had a look at him. It's all changed. And so, you know, that's why, thank God, we did movies, you know. Because not even the television shows, like you never see Freddie Prinze, you know that Chico and the Man, never see any reruns of those, you know.
Yeah.
But
Up in Smoke, everybody's still Up in Smoke, discovering
them. It's a staple. It's a rite of childhood passage. In fact, it's a conversation. If you can't talk Up in Smoke, then buddy, you better go see that movie. Then we'll talk.
And with that, you definitely were a rite of passage in my life. And the reason I'm a comedian, the reason I'm a podcaster now is because of you and because of my mother for having that album where you guys are sitting in the car and then you pull it out and there's weed in the door. And what do those cochinos mean in English anyway?
Two pigs.
Two pigs. Okay.
Yeah, two dirty guys.
Too dirty.
Oh, cochino.
Well, Howie, I've had a blast talking to you. I could talk to you all day. If there's anything you want to promote, I know you have CBD products. You have water pipes that you're not going to go to jail for selling. Have your own kush. You got all sorts of stuff. If you want to promote, please promote what you have.
What you mean right now?
Yeah, if you want.
No. Tommy Chong CBD, you know, that's all over the place. And starting to piss people off. That's a good sign. You know?
Okay.
Yeah, well, I turn on my computer and you pop up all the time. So that's our CBD. And Cheech and Chong dispensaries are going to be opening up very, very shortly.
Wow.
And so we'll have that. And we'll be on. I'll come on your show when that happens. And we'll.
That sounds
we'll
great.
Right.
I would love that. Right.
Okay.
Hey. Tommy, you're the best.
Okay, you are the greatest.
Thank you. I hope you had a good time. I had such a great time talking to you. It's a dream come true.
I always have a good time talking about myself.
No problem. Bye-bye, everybody. Try your products.
Oh, yeah, try it out. And I'm waiting for that goodie bag.
It's coming. Guaranteed.
Okay. Bye-bye. We'll see you next time.